really rare circuit there. K4NBC with a little bit of delay. K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW from K4NBC. Well, the other thing is I can't start my helicopter on a switching supply, but on this linear supply, I could. That's why once I got it working, I wanted to make it switchable from 24 to 28 volts DC, because this thing will put out about 60 to 75 amps. A ham that I know that's got one of these told me that you get 400 watts out of each one of those boards in there, and there's five of them. So if this thing will run it to 2 kW PEP, then it's got to be 60 to 75 amps.
Everybody got their new AT&T BlackBerry? It's 4G, so you can do more.
What the hell is this? Hold on.
Does sound like Bob ran into a bit of an emergency there of some kind. I went and bought a 100 ampere, 28 volt power supply. It needed 240 volts of input, AC, 60 cycles, on the internet a couple of years ago for a particular project I was on. And I seem to remember spending like $150, $200. It wasn't very expensive. So if you do a web search for 100 amperes, 28 volt power supply, regulated power supply, I wish I could remember the brand name that we selected, but there were quite a significant number of them available, and for only a couple of $100. So getting 28 volts at 100 amps from a 220 volt supply off the internet is relatively easy 2 years ago, and I'd like to believe they're still available today. K4NBC, if you're still there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, sorry about that interruption. K2RIW from K4NBC. Some pop-up ad or something jumped in there, and I just had to close every window on the computer till it went away. All right, well, anyway, that's the dilemma that I'm facing. Now, the other alternative is running this amplifier off a 24-volt switching supply, which you can buy for dirt on eBay. I've already looked at the 28-volt stuff and other places. But nonetheless, suppose I want to run this amp on a switching supply. Do you believe a switching supply will cover the current variations that a large amplifier like this would put on it there? Or do you think I'd be better off with the linear supply? By the way, this unit has 1980 to 1983 date codes in it, so I'm dating it at 1983, which was the dawn of the switching supply era. What do you think? What's your opinion on the amplifier here? Run it on a switching supply, or run it on the linear supply? Bear in mind, we are running. I am going to be using it on sideband and not CW or FM. K2RIW from K4ANBC. In the bottle of water.
This is DTZ with a comment. Hal, recognize. I got some relatively good news for you, Bob. That experiment that I was using, the 100 ampere, 28 volt power supply, which was fed on 220 volts, 60 cycle AC, I was doing that experiment 2 or 3 years ago. It was an extremely highly linear amplifier at 900 megacycles, and I was generating 1500 watts of power for a particular experiment. And it was a switching type power supply. So off the internet, 220 volts input, there was no transformer in this thing. The power supply itself, I seem to remember it was about 4 inches wide, 6 inches high, 18 inches front to back, and lots of great big capacitors in there. It was a switching power supply, no transformer of any kind, and it was putting out 28 volts at 100 amperes. We used that to run these amplifiers and had absolutely no problem. The worst that will happen is that if your switching rate is, let me pick a number, 50 kilohertz, you might have a little bit of 50 kilohertz sideband in the output of the transmitter. You may have to do a little bit of extra filtering to notch out the 50 kilohertz. The switching rate of the power supply could give you a little bit of a sideband if your specification happens to be, all sidebands have to be 60 dB down to be FCC compliant or something like that. But you, with a good spectrum analyzer, you have the technology to address that. So don't be afraid of switching power supplies, feeding an amplifier, in my opinion. Yeah, there's been a... Let me drop... There have been a couple of horror stories of some of the amateur radio purchased equipment 5 years ago with a switching power supply feeding a nice compact, a no-tune amplifier, became a little bit unreliable or gave them some grief in sideband. There's been a couple of stories like that, but that's just a matter of ironing out the bugs in the design and the early production models, if you know what I mean. There are some essentially milled spec switching power supplies, 28 volts at near 100 amperes. There's a lot of them for very nice prices on the internet. And once again, don't be afraid of a switcher into an amplifier from my particular experience. K6DPZ, now what would you suggest, Hal? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DPZ. Well, Dick, I work with the ICOM PW1s, the Quadras, and also the JL2000. All of them are high-power SSD linear amplifiers. They all have switching supplies, and they do a very good job. It's best to go that route instead of a linear supply. The weight, the dynamic range, they went from 90 to 250 volts AC input. It's a no-brainer. Go ahead, Dick.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, Glenn recognized, and Hal's brought up some very good points. If you go to linear, you tend to have a great big power transformer. You tend to have a lot of weight, a lot of dissipation. The linear regulator probably is going to run, let me pick a number, 75% efficiency. That means 25% of the power it generates it's giving off as heat. Whereas the switchers, you can come up with much higher numbers, 90-95% efficiency type numbers. So choose the right switching regulator, and I think the problem goes away. I bet you've used a lot of high power switching regulators in your time, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think so, Dick. As a matter of fact, all I use is switching regulators and switching power supplies. And that's that one of the Achilles heel of switching power supply, you know, Delta Q, Alpha X-ray doing. If you have a fixed voltage power supply and you have a changing output current, especially in sideband, what will happen is there's a point to where the power supply is an idling current to full load current. And you have to watch that dynamic range window. Usually what you want to do is to have some preload or minimum loading current always on the power supply to keep it from a no-load operation, so that when you're in sideband and you start drawing current out of the power supply, you already have the minimum current being drawn to the maximum peaks. The manufacturers of most, like Yaesu and other companies who produce these other high-power switches, have already taken this consideration into mind. Let me let it drop. The problem with not paying attention to it, in other words, if you have a switching regulator on the bench where in SSB mode, when you first key down, your idling current could be less than an amp. And under full modulation, you could be up near 100 amps. And now what you're doing is you're trying to modulate the switching regulator current from 1 to 100 amps, and then from 100 back to 1 again. What could happen is you can go through an instability in the feedback circuit, because if you have an output inductor that's going to have current in it where it's continuous, and what I mean by continuous meaning that the ripple current, the load current has to be greater than the ripple current in the output. If it's not, what will happen is if you keep on drawing load current through the continuity point of the output inductor, you will have an instability. So as long as you know that you're drawing currents that are within the dynamic range of the switching regulator, you should have no problem. It is something to keep in mind. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
John recognized. We'll get to you in a second now, John. Alpha Zulu X-ray. Alpha X-ray Zulu. Very good point. Yep. C series inductor that's smoothing out the switching regulator outputs. When you go from a fraction of an ampere to 100 amperes on each half cycle of the speech, if your speech is giving you all kinds of very rapid envelopes that you would see on a sampling oscilloscope, not a sampling oscilloscope, a one of these monitor oscilloscope type things, sideband is a very wicked load factor. So by putting in a minimum bleeder resistor or some other kind of regulator network in there, you can handle that. Simply putting in a bleeder resistor so that it's continuously drawing 5 amperes when you're not speaking into the sideband transmitter, and now you're modulating between 5 and 80 as opposed to between nearly 0 and 80, where it can't handle that. I mean, what the switching regulator's got to do is it's got to change its pulse width modulation and or switching frequency or the combination. And so it's got a certain dynamic range. It gives you real good regulation between, we'll say, 80 amperes and 5 amperes, but you swing rapidly between more than 80 or less than 5. You can get these instabilities at certain speech frequencies. So it's not a serious problem. There's a solvable thing to it, but the first time you see it, it could drive you up a wall.
Dick, I also have one other suggestion.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
D2HWW, would a comment on this subject, please?
Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
The resistor or the preload is one way of dealing with it, but it's sometimes lossy and not a very, very sexy solution. If you have room in a large power supply like this or external between the power supply and the transmitter, you have some room where you could put a box and put some capacitors in it. Capacitors are a very, very nice solution here also. What do I mean? If you look at the envelope of current that in sideband operation that the transmitter is going to require, you can basically look at what your peak current condition will be and the minimum current condition is, and then figure out what the lowest audible frequency that your voice tone is probably going to key up in sideband, which is usually somewhere between about 60 and 100 hertz, somewhere in that area. And you take the lowest frequency that you think, and then you look at your voltage, say it's a 28-volt power supply. You don't want it to drop below 24. So from 28 to 24 is the maximum amount of droop that you're going to allow. And then just calculate C dB dt, put that amount of capacitance inside this capacitance box, and problem cured. Because when you key down that transmitter, hit that current load, if this way the initial current spike comes out of the capacitor bank, and the power supply will just then try to recharge the capacitors, and you're back in action. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, very good point. In the case of regulators, adding extra computer-grade filter capacitors after the regulator before the variable load device like this transmitter does a tremendous amount of smoothing, and a well-designed power supply, no problem. And that is opposite of what happens when you're feeding a cyclic AC load, like say for instance a loudspeaker. In case of feeding a loudspeaker, extra capacitance can make the driving amplifier with its feedback unstable. That kind of network doesn't like to see extra capacitance, but a power supply filter network, yeah, beautiful way to go. And so now the power supply doesn't have to operate in microseconds. It can take a significant number of milliseconds before the voltage on the capacitors can droop, and the switching power supply can easily handle that rate of change. The next person who signed in with a comment on this one was John. Kilo Delta 2 Alpha X-ray Zulu. Go right ahead with your comment, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2HWW with a comment.
Howie, I recognize you. John first. John, go ahead. Okay, John signed in earlier, but go ahead, Howie, with your comment.
Dick, hello to everybody. Let me tell you what happened with me. I needed a heavy-duty power supply for my repeater system. I've tried using Samlex and other power switching supplies. Problem with switching supplies that I found in my application, their switching rate with a pair in the main carrier, because we have upside-down repeater that would be interfering with other repeaters, I have been trying to use Astron supplies. I finally got an Astron power supply, very heavily modified. And what do I mean by that? This is a 12-volt supply that can probably handle about 80 amperes continuous. We added four more transistors were added. So now the power supply has 12 transistors instead of 4. Astron makes a 28-volt or a 24-volt linear supply. In this application, I would probably use a linear supply. But what we did is we went from 2N3771s to 2N5886s, and we had an extra tail put in. So in our supply, instead of having 8 transistors, we now have 12 transistors, so each transistor can handle 1/12 the power instead of 1/8 the current capability. And another thing, I found this out, is a lot of situations your line voltage is very high and use a buck boost and reduce the input voltage to the power supply just low enough that it still works. The supply won't have to work as hard. Back to you, Dick, and I will have pictures up on the website showing what was done. But we took an Astron supply and had it heavily modified, put in some extra cooling and extra fans. K2RIW, WD2H.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Did you hear?
Yeah, you only timed out the last half second. Let me drop. Yeah, the super conservative approach is a linear power supply with lots of heat dissipation capability. But when you're getting to the kind of power that Bob is talking about, I don't think he wants to heat up his flower to room, if you know what I mean. The switching, the fantastic, what's the word I'm looking for, efficiency that you can get out of the switching regulator, although it requires some extra care, I think it's worth fighting for. It's not as conservative approach, but Bob has the technology with the spectrum analyzer and whatever, and a good oscilloscope. He would be able to see these instabilities, and with the right kind of a filter capacitor network after the switching regulator, and his amount of steam that he's generating there, multiple kilowatts in that power supply, it's awful nice not to have the power transformer, not to have the heat dissipation of the switching, of the linear regulating transistors. If I was in his shoes, I would know it's a little bit of extra effort required, but it's worth it in the long run to go to the switcher. That's an opinion, how he expressed his opinion, and Bob's going to weigh all of the above. I think fixing the power supply you've got is going to be kind of hard, and just going out and buying one for a couple hundred bucks making the problem go away. Let us know what you decide on this one, Bob. K4, National Broadcasting Company, K2RIW and the TechNet.
All right, Dick. Well, the trick is, right now, my thinking is weighed in on drawing out a schematic of both these boards and this whole regulator circuit and get these thyristors firing properly. Once I can make this thing work on 24 volts, then I can figure out how to make it work on 28. I'm looking at these rare value resistors here with a suspicious eye. As far as the amplifier goes, yeah, I wanted to run a switching supply on it. The stuff that I want to run it with is very expensive, unavailable, and made by Harris. So I've got to come up with another alternative, the Lambdas and Aztecs. I'm looking at there, so I'll probably throw inductor, iron core inductor on each leg, and throw a 1 farad capacitor across it, and cross my fingers and say, here we go.
Yeah, be careful with putting a series inductor, Bob. As you go from full load to a very low load, and you've got a series inductor in your filter network after the power supply, before the load, you get a nasty inductive kickback characteristic. In other words, you're shouting into the mic for a little while, you're drawing 80 amperes, and the inductor is storing a whole lot of magnetic current, a whole lot of magnetic field, and then you stop talking into the mic, and the transmitter goes down to 1 ampere of a standby current drawer, and all of a sudden, all of that stored magnetic energy in that inductor makes your 28-volt output go to 56 volts, so to speak, for a brief period of time. And yes, there's ways you can protect with you know, really stoochy Zener diodes and things like that, or with a, let's see now, you don't want a crowbar circuit, because you don't want to make a short circuit, but some kind of a regulator that kicks in when it sees over voltage. So a series inductor is a tough way to go. I would go with, if the series inductor is small enough in Henry's, then maybe it's not going to be any grief. So be a little bit careful on that one. I've seen people use a series inductor on the cigarette lighter out of an automobile to try to get rid of the alternator whine, and they didn't realize that when they go from full current on a, say, 160-watt Mirage amplifier in the automobile, and you're drawing 18 amperes, and then you suddenly switch off that amplifier, and all that magnetic current stored in that inductor comes back and things. So let us know how that goes, Bob. Sounds like a fascinating project. And I think you're telling us that that solid-state amplifier you bought is, I believe you said, 3 to 30 megacycles, and I think it's capable of a conservative 1,500 watts peak envelope power output.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think you said it's capable of...
That is correct. And by the way, it's not the amplifier I want to run on 28 volts. My 28-volt NiCad battery for the chopper is no good anymore. I have to rebuild it, and that's going to cost a fortune, about $3,000. I have nothing to start the chopper up with, and, you know, that thing has a starter generator in it. And you throw an inductive load like that on a switching supply, that thing's going to crowbar. Motor probably won't even turn 1/10 of a rev. So this linear 100-pound beast here has a future.
It sure does. What I think you're saying is that the generator system on your jet engine for that Bell helicopter, I think you're saying locked rotor is going to draw a fierce amount of current when you first close the switch. And so if there was a current switching network on your switching power supply, if it had simple current limiting, all would be well. If it really had a crowbar circuit that switched itself completely off, yeah, that's a problem. Or what you really want is a kind of a fold-back power supply. And there's ways of making fold-back current limiting so that during the locked rotor, it will put out more than 80 amperes. I guess the next thing we got to worry about is, let's assume that your switching regulator is good for 80 or 100 amps. Will that locked rotor motor start moving at 80 amps, or does it need a surge of 400 amps to make it first start to move? What's your guess on that one, Bob? K4NBC, K2RIW.
I don't remember off the top of my head. Those records are in another room. I think it draws about 15 to 20 amps, somewhere in that ballpark. And I have to maintain the voltage within 1 volt. Otherwise, I can wind up with a hot start, which is a damaged engine. So I gotta be, right at 28 volts the whole time. You go up to 29 or 30, you risk a hot start, and another one, you know, the ignition system won't fire. So I need 28 volts plus or minus 1/2 volt. Now, what it does is it's a starter generator, and for those of you who forgot, it's a series shunt, a series motor. And when it's turning, it's basically it's turning a bunch of fans, because that's what a jet engine is. And once it gets, also the power supply is turning on the fuel system, and it is also firing a high tension discharge ignition system. Once the fire starts in the engine, then you switch to the generator mode, and now you're running off of ship power instead of ground power. So I want to make this a GPU and run the amplifier off the switch.
I'm waiting to see if Bob timed out his machine and if he's coming back. Are you there, Bob?
Yeah, timed out just as I was unkeying. Back to net control, K2RIW from K4NBC.
Now, although you've got a complicated inductive series-wound motor with its weird load line characteristics, as long as you've got a big enough filter capacitor network between your power supply, your switching power supply, and that load, I'm pretty sure that'll be fairly nicely controlled. One other thing that I recommend in your particular case, where you've got a half volt of tolerance on 28, plus or minus a half, I would strongly recommend that you make the switching power supply regulator function have remote sensing. In other words, right at the place where the 28 volts has to be accurate, plus or minus half a volt, I would have a separate piece of wire going back to the power supply, no matter where it's located. So with remote sensing, you can make sure that at the point of criticality, that's where the voltage is being measured, not at the output of the power supply. I'm reasonably sure you've already considered that, but I thought I'd throw that in just to be double darn sure. Back to you, Bob. K4NBC, K2RIW.
Well, then the ideal thing would be if I was going to start it up on a switching supply for ground power, I would just mount the damn supply in the back with right next to the battery there. There's plenty of room. And next to the, the beacon, come to think of it. And then go down to Home Depot and get an RV AC plug so I can just plug an AC extension cord into it. Keep the supply built into the chopper, start up off of that, switch the battery, and fly off. All right, sounds like a plan, Dick. I don't want to hog it up there. There's others with woes out there, so and I got to get started on something else here. So enjoyed it, and thanks for the help and everything. And the temperature went down to 70, so it's getting cold down here. K2RIW 73s, and everybody else, and Howie, good evening. This is K4NBC in the Bartow, Florida.
The power supply that your switching regulator that you're thinking of using as a substitute, the previous power supply that needs a $3,000 repair, where did the raw power for it one come from? Was that a battery network where the batteries are defective? Or was that also running on ground side 220 power? Back to you for a quick one on that one, Bob.
Now, when I bought the chopper, it came with a NiCad battery. The size of this, this was a military chopper. It doesn't have the civilian battery. The civilian battery is about as big as three motorcycle batteries put together. This battery that came with my chopper is about as big as an SB220 amplifier. That's all I had to start the thing with, but the cells in it have gone bad, and they are rebuildable. Safra wants says it's a $5,000 battery, so being that I'm not flying it, I'm working on it. 28-volt power supply would be the best bet, because once I rebuild that battery, it's got a calendar life to it, so everything in aviation costs money by the minute.
On Long Island, they say something that you probably heard while you used to live here. In the case of aviation and boats, if you have to ask what it costs, you probably can't afford it. Now, one last question I got for you. Used to be there, and then you've now got some dead cells. That gives you, I guess, the ability to restart in the air. Where you're going to be using a ground-side power supply for starting up, is there any kind of an FAA requirement where you must have the ability to restart after you're airborne? Over to you, Bob.
Well, number one, I would say it sure helps. I mean, really, it's nice to have that option. I'm not aware of any particular regulation. The book is about 4 inches thick. I don't know of any manufacturer that makes something that you can't restart in flight, with the exception of the space shuttle. I knew they forgot something.
Yeah, well, you're running on ground-side power to start up without your built-in battery, and therefore you don't have the ability to restart. In theory, if the shopper is used in the normal manner, you should never get a flame out, and a restart in the air should never be required. Although, I wonder if there are choppers somewhat like yours that have an auxiliary power unit that is capable of supplying that function. But even that would need a starting battery. But the auxiliary power unit, I guess some of those could be started on a few motorcycle batteries. You might have some comments on this one, Bob. As you can tell, I've got an interest in aviation. K4NBC, K2RIW, without much knowledge on it. You got it, Bob.
I do know this. For lack of stay out of FAA terminology, it's illegal to run a APU while you are in flight. And I know a guy who had a Bell 47 down the road in Lantana here. His name was Larry Tim. And one night, this was the end of his aviation career, but one night he got all liquored up and smoked some crack. He hopped in his Bell 47 with a generator, and he had this electronic sign that said, "Jesus saves." And he mounted it to the tail, you know, the boom of the helicopter, the tail rotor boom, which looks like a tower section. So he had one of those little Honda 500-watt handheld generators, you know, one of those quiet things. He strapped it down with the into the passenger seat, and he fired the thing up, and he rode up and down the beach with his Jesus Saves sign. When they found out that he was running a generator known as an APU, that was the end of him. They fined him right out of ownership of his chopper and punched his tickets and everything. So no APUs allowed in flight. Batteries, good. Good to go.
Now, I thought that some of the commercial airliners, I know that there's APUs on the space shuttle for sure, I thought some of the commercial airliners have a built-in APU. Now, in the case of his ham radio APU, which really was a motor generator set sitting on the passenger seat with gasoline inside the passenger compartment that can be filled, I can see why there's a zillion FAA rules against that one. But a properly installed APU on your tail boom with a separate fuel supply to it, I'm amazed that something like that couldn't be made legal. Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
Okay, for those of you out there that don't know, an APU means auxiliary power unit, to wit, a generator. In the case of the ones on airliners, they run on jet fuel, and they are, in fact, turbine-powered. They have a small engine in them. Many of them are the solar T-62 turbine engine. It weighs like 27 pounds and will deliver about 100 horsepower. They're very popular for these one-man, you know, single-seat little jet-powered helicopters that you can build from kits. It's a turbine engine, and it turns the generator in the APU in the aircraft, which generates 120 volts, 400 cycles, and 28 volts DC. Also, it blows air. It blows air through the vents and powers the air conditioning system of the aircraft, and it vents through the wheel wells of the aircraft. The APU is usually located in the port side wheel well of the aircraft, and the exhaust vents through there. Can't vent exhaust with the gear up and the door closed, so that's why, you know, you can't use them on airlines. K2 RIW K4 NBC.
Interesting. I'm amazed that some of the APUs, turbine type APU, could not be quasi co-located with, say, for instance, a tail engine, an engine mounted in the vertical stabilizer, because I can see times when the APU supplying hydraulic power, air conditioning power, would not be useful. Are none of the commercial airliners doing it that way, Bob? Are all the APUs only mounted in the port wheel well? K4 NBC, K2 RIW.
In Boeing and Airbus aircraft, yeah. It's a easy maintenance point because maintenance is done on the ground, so why not have the gear down and the bay open? But maintenance can be performed on that thing in the wheel well. And as a matter of fact, there's a lot of stuff in the wheel well that have nothing to do with the landing system at all. They're in there as easy access points or for rapid inspection. Venting the exhaust is done straight down. Something else. Oh yeah, that's what I was going to say. I also stated that they blow air, and in order to start the airplane, let's say you're the first pilot out there in the morning and you're going to start it up. You first must start up the APU. That's the very first thing you do. Then you get all your instruments and systems going, and you start doing your checks and stuff. And then when you decide to start the engine, basically you're controlling an air duct, because these engines on jet airplanes don't start with electric starter motors like you've got in your car or on your lawnmower or motorcycle. They start with compressed air. So that APU will channel air through a duct and start turning, let's say, the number one engine, which then the pilot will switch on the ignition and then the fuel supply, and then once that engine is up and running on its own, he can direct.
Bob, the last words we heard is that once he gets the number one engine running, he can then direct, and I presume you're going to say the generator of that first engine can then be used to start the other engines. Is that approximately the procedure?
Whoops, sorry about that. But anyway, you can also, once he's got one of the engines running, he can use compressed air from that engine to start the others. So in a way, there is a way of starting in flight as long as you have compressed air. If it's a two-engine plane and he lost both engines and he can't run air from one engine to the other, I guess in an emergency, I would drop the gear and fire the APU up and start sending air into the engines again and see if I could get them started up. But on these newer planes now, all this stuff is computer controlled, and everything's all thought and mapped out and everything, and you just basically sit there like an idiot watching the screen while it automatically relogs in.
Fascinating. Okay. In coming weeks, I've got a whole bunch more questions that next week or the week after I'll be asking you about these exact subjects you were just now discussing. The compressed air, I'm going to guess it gets ducted near the compressor. Let's see now. Where would be the best place to duct the compressed air to turn the turbine of a jet engine? Would you do it on the compressor blades or the turbine blades? I'm guessing the compressor blades. I'm guessing there's a way you open up a trap door, the compressor blades, you see the extra air blowing through, and that spins up the turbine. Had a quick break on that one. Am I close, Bob? K4 NBC, K2 RIW.
You do it in the N1 stage.
Okay, and I'm going to have to look that one up. We'll be discussing this in the future. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in, with the exception of Paul, who's going to tell us what's going on in space. But of the people who signed in with a question, let me double check to make sure I didn't skip over anybody. K2LIW.
K2MU.
K2 Mike Uniform. Start off with your name, sir. And go right ahead.
Okay, good evening. Name here is Bernie. I hope you're copying me okay. My question is concerning my antenna. I live in a six-story apartment building, and I'm running a vertical dipole out the second-story window. One wire goes up to the roof, and one wire goes straight down almost to the ground. So the hot end goes about 60 feet up, about maybe 55 feet up, and the outer conductor drops about 20 feet. That's my antenna, and it works great. On almost all the bands, it tunes flat. It's flat against the building, and I'm facing west and north. So it's working out great. Let me drop it, and I'll tell you my question. Okay. I have three questions regarding the antenna. One is, I'm assuming that the building is acting as some kind of reflector. I'm amazed at how well it's been working out for me. I'm just curious if you could, you know, tell me a little bit about the radiation pattern of what's going on there. My main question is, I cannot tune the thing up with my MFJ tuner on 10 and 12 meters. I guess that makes sense. It's too big for those bands. But I was just curious what's going on there. I can tune it flat on all the bands except for 10 and 12. So there's something going on with the impedance. Is there anything I could do in the shack? By the way, I have a poor man's balance feeding the dipole. 30 gauge copper enamel red wire, so you can't even see it's on the apartment building. And finally, last question is, just the other day, the outer conductor part of the antenna fell off. And no problem to put it back on, but I was just curious how that would affect, I'm still able to tune it up flat, but I'm curious how it would affect the radiation pattern. So, there you go. Okay, back to you, Dick.
That's a fascinating sounding antenna, Bernie. And you're taking quite a few of the suggestions that we on the TechNet have been saying for some time now. A vertical dipole, whether it's fed in the center, off-center, or at one end, is an antenna that has not been given anywhere near the amount of emphasis that it deserves. And you're doing it, and you seem to be rather happy with it. But on a quick break before I start answering your questions, on 10 and 12 meters, where you're not able to tune it, at a low enough power where your transmitter doesn't trip out, you probably are able to measure the apparent standing wave ratio. What do you believe is the standing wave ratio at 10 and 12 meters, Bernie? K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW.
Okay, that's a good question. Not really sure. All I know is it's way too high on those bands. I cannot get the standing wave ratio anywhere near acceptable with the tuner or without it. But I don't know exactly what it is or what's the best I can get.
Yeah, you're into the area now that I have been addressing for some time, and that is a company that makes an antenna tuner, whether it's an automatic antenna tuner built into the transmitter itself or whether it's a separate unit. In either case, when you really study what the antenna tuner is capable of doing, and if you took all of the areas on the Smith chart tells you all possible impedances, high and low resistance, inductive reactance, capacitor reactance, all possible impedances of every single antenna on planet Earth is a dot at one frequency somewhere on that chart. As such, a really self-respecting antenna tuner company should give you a map. The map should be of the Smith chart, and a certain area of the Smith chart is colored in, saying that these are the areas where this antenna tuner can give you a good match. And so even though the manufacturer may give you a really dumb spec, the dumb spec is that this thing will match anything up to a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, well, standing wave ratio all phases. However, there probably is are certain key phases where the standing wave ratio could be 15 to 1, and as long as it's the right phase angle, the Smith chart could work it for you, could give you the match. Let me drop. A good self-respecting antenna tuner company should give you that. Now, you as a scientist, Bernie, have one other solution, and that is if you had the schematic diagram of your antenna tuner, in other words, it's got, most likely it's a Pi network or an L network or a Pi L network, but the first capacitor, C1, you know what the maximum and minimum number of picofarads it's got. The series inductor in the Pi network, you know the maximum and minimum nanohenries or microhenries it can go to. And the C2 capacitor, you know the maximum and minimum it can go to. With that raw information, you could, with some effort, calculate exactly what portions of the Smith chart you could color in your own Smith chart. And once you do that, and you publish that data, people will come to your doorstep and be very happy. they will say, it's about time. You will shame the company that built that antenna tuner that he didn't do it first, that K2MU did it first. So that's what's needed. Once you find out, by one means or another, what part of the Smith chart you can handle, you then have the choice of, by one means or another, let me drop. You can measure the real impedance of your antenna that you see in the shack on 10 and 12 meters. You'll find out that maybe it's a 12-ohm resistor and a 100-ohm capacitor, so to speak, in series with each other as the equivalent circuit of your antenna measured in the shack on 10 meters, we'll say. And therefore, that will tell you what length of coax cable will rotate you into right part of the Smith chart. Once you know the real standing wave ratio of your antenna, that allows you to draw a circle with a compass of a certain diameter with the point of the compass in the center of the Smith chart, and you set the right diameter of the compass, and you draw the circle on the Smith chart. That circle represents, everywhere on that circle is, in my example, a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. The only thing that changes as you go to different points on that circle is you're changing the phase angle of the reflection. Once you know that the phase angle of the reflection on that circle will equal the good part of the Smith chart where your antenna tuner can handle, that tells you what length of cable to add. As you add extra cable, extra feed line between the shack and your current feed line, you're rotating along that circle you just drew with the compass, and if it goes into the sweet spot on the Smith chart where your antenna tuner can handle it, you're home free. Let me drop. That's one possible kind of very scientific approach, and you publish that chart as to what that particular brand name of antenna tuner can handle, and lots of people will say, boy, it's about time, and Bernie is the first guy, these guys in New York City, to know what they're doing. They know how to do it right. That's one approach. Another approach is you borrow, beg, steal, buy, whatever, somebody's antenna analyzer. That really is a kind of a standing wave ratio bridge that's a little bit more sophisticated, that once you adjust the dials on your antenna analyzer, it tells you that your antenna acts like a 10-ohm resistor and a 50-ohm capacitor, so to speak. You'll measure the exact impedance of the antenna in the shack. That gives you the ability to then make an L network, to make some kind of a network. It could be a stub tuner with coax cable on a T connector. It could be a real inductor with a capacitor in the box. By various means, you can make another impedance-matching black box, or as I said, a T connector, somewhere on your feed line with the right length of cable for the stub on the T connector. You can correct the impedance of your antenna on 10 and 12 meters, one at a time at least. And therefore, with that extra stub, you'll bring the antenna into a much more friendly standing wave ratio, and now your antenna tuner will handle it. So you don't have to give up on the antenna. There's ways you can tune that antenna from the shack. You just have to give your antenna tuner a little bit of help, either by extra length of line, a stub tuner, or an L network, or whatever. Let me drop. Now, your other question is that the portion of your antenna that went up is 55 feet long. The portion that went down is 20 feet long, which means that you've got an off-center fed dipole with a poor man's balun. The poor man's balun is a very effective thing. A few turns of coax cable of the right diameter taped together as a kind of a series RF choke mounted near the antenna. It doesn't have to be exactly at the antenna, but somewhere in the vicinity, is a poor man's choke, which means that the amount of current that wants to flow back down the outside of your coax cable doesn't get a chance to do so. It hits that choke and stops. So you've now got a kind of a balun on an off-center fed vertical dipole, and it'll work like a charm. There's nothing magic about setting up a dipole like it is in the books. Let me drop. All the study guides and all of the schematic diagrams we've seen in electronics books say that when you set up a halfway dipole, the photograph and the diagram they show you is a dipole that is thoroughly parallel to the ground, out straight, with the insulators on the end, an insulator in the center, and the feed line in the center. And that you're led to believe that if you do anything else, the antenna is going to explode, it's not going to work, and bad things are going to happen. Absolutely, positively not true. Because of your particular physical layout, that horizontal dipole doesn't have to be horizontal. Doesn't have to be all out straight. The wire itself, you can put the loading coils in the beginning, in the center of it. You can put top hat capacitors at the tip. The wire itself can be zigzag back and forth, left and right, up and down. The ends can be turned up, turned down, whatever. You can set it up any old way you want. In the case of a vertical dipole, the same thing. The fact that you've got the 55-foot length going up and then over parallel to the roof for a certain period of time, there's nothing magic about a vertical dipole being everywhere vertical. And there's a couple of very good reasons for this. Let me drop. It's nice to know that you're launching a purely vertical signal. And if you're a naive person and the guy you're talking to in London is also using a vertical antenna, you'd say, oh boy, we guys are co-polarized and we're going to get the best signal to each other. Absolutely not true. That signal to get over to London has got to bounce off the ionosphere two or three times. Each time it goes through that ionosphere, it gets twisted in polarization. It's called Faraday rotation. The ionosphere is a plasma. Whenever you mix a plasma with Earth's magnetic field, it will give you polarization rotation. And the rotation is not fixed. If you could have some very fancy polarimetry measuring instrumentation over there in London, and you look at the instantaneous polarization that gets there from your vertically polarized launching signal in New York, you'll discover that the polarization in London is continuously rotating back and forth. Sometimes the signal is skipping over London, but most of the time he's getting QSB fades because the polarization is rotating. Therefore, do you have to work real hard to launch a purely vertical signal that's got no horizontal components, or vice versa? As you can see, you're wasting your time to worry about that detail, because no matter how you launch the signal, your highest priority is to launch as many of the watts as you can out into the air. And a nice thing about a vertical dipole is it tends to give you a very low elevation angle, and therefore it's going to give you a nice bounce off the ionosphere, and you're going to get some nice DX. Let me drop. But there's nothing magic about launching a particular polarization, because the Mother Nature's ionosphere is going to skew it up for you royally, and she's going to continuously be changing it. So, is your building giving you a reflection? Yeah. Is your building giving you some absorption? Yeah. Is it twisting the polarization? Yeah. You could, if you want to, find out what are the materials in the building, and in theory you can go to a modern-day three-dimensional computer modeling program, and you could model the building, model the antenna, and figure out exactly what the antenna pattern is, and what the polarization is, and what the efficiency is, and whatever. It'd be a nice academic exercise. But every environment we've got is complicated. Yours, you know yours is complicated because you're wrapping it around the building. The rest of us have a complicated environment because we think the trees are not there. They are. We think the downspouts on the house are not there, and the gutters, and the wiring, and the conduit tubing in the house, and the plumbing, and everything else. We think our environment is simple, and you think your environment is complicated. I got news for you. They're all complicated. The real pattern we're getting in the real world and the real polarization we're launching in many cases is quite different than we expect. I know I haven't given you an answer, but I've given you some of the details of letting you know some of the complication involved. But I'm glad you had the faith to launch that antenna. Sounds to me as like it's nice and successful. Sounds to me as like it's almost invisible. I think you should be writing some articles in what you're doing, Bernie. I think you're blazing a trail that a lot of people should be doing, because you're solving a problem that a lot of guys in the metro area have. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Simulant of structural antenna system.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, lots of in-depth information there for sure. Yeah, well, it's working out really well. Well, just picture a vertical dive wire dipole about 75 feet from the ground up into the air. It's going straight to the roof. And this area of Queens, northern Queens, is elevated a bit, so the factors are definitely working out great, way better than I expect. On all the bands, I'm basically heard with my 100 watts. Most of the time I'm heard, and you know, DX is not a problem. Follow up, if I can, real quick, double check with you the bound that I made. The diameter should be about 10 inches, more or less. That's what I have it at, more or less. About 4 or 5 turns, about 10 inches, 10, 12 inches. I was reading the size of a dinner plate. But more importantly, and then that's my last question, I'll let it go, as I mentioned, the counterpoise just fell off a couple of days ago. And I know I've listened to some of the tech nets where you talk about the importance of the counterpoise. Right now I just have a 55-foot piece of wire going straight up to the roof. I'm just curious. I'm going to put the counterpoise back on, but I'm just curious what happens to the signal when that happens. K2RIW and the TechNet K2MU.
Let me make sure I understand what you just said, Bernie. Is the 20 feet going down toward the ground that gets connected to the shield of your feed line, is that what you're calling the counterpoise? I think the answer is yes. And your actual transmission cable, how many feet of what kind of cable is it? Over to you, Bernie.
Oh, okay, yes. That's what I'm calling the counterpoise, number one. And number two, it's about 25 feet of RG58. Yeah, about 25 feet of RG58U or whatever it is. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you had an antenna analyzer and you're measuring what impedance you see in the shack at each one of your favorite bands, and then you disconnect that lower 20 feet, that impedance is going to become an extremely different thing. In general, the standing wave ratio probably is going to get higher because you've got an off-center fed dipole, and now you're feeding it as a kind of a long wire, a monopole, but because of your poor man's balance, you don't have a real good ground to launch that monopole signal with. The counterpoise is missing. I think that this wire is going to be so high on some of the bands, you're not going to like it. So you're definitely going to want to reconnect that counterpoise. Off-center fed dipole works like a charm, but where the other half is not there. I mean, you could feed a dipole from the bottom end and don't bother putting a center insulator, if you know what I mean. However, you need a local ground, something as a counterpoise. The signal, the current that you're trying to launch into one end of the antenna, you got to be standing on something substantial to push against, if you know what I mean. You've heard me give the example of Arnold Schwarzenegger floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle while he's in free space, while he's in zero gravity, and when he pushes that 200-pound barbell away from him at 1 meter per second to the north, he, as a 200-pound man, is going to move 1 meter per second to the south. You're pushing the two, it's action and reaction, Newton's third law, and you've got the equivalent of that electronically. Let me drop. So the counterpoise acts like that other piece of mass that you can push against. And by the way, you wound your poor man's ballon out of 10-inch diameter cable, and you probably know it should have been 11.14 inches in diameter. That's a joke. Any number of turns of any diameter gives you that poor man's ballon. There's no magic diameter. There's no magic number of turns. If you want to be a purist, you could then go to the equation that you've got in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where if you're winding a solenoid coil and you tell that equation what is the length of the coil, what is the diameter of the coil, and how many turns per inch and how many turns are there, you plug in all the numbers and it tells you how many microhenries the coil has. Let me drop. So your poor man's ballon is a RF choke. It's got some number of microhenries. And there's a zillion ways you can come up with what you believe is the right number of microhenries. To be a perfect poor man's ballon, you want some minimum number of microhenries. If at your operating frequency, that poor man's ballon acts like an RF choke, and if that at your operating frequency, that RF choke, X sub L equals 2 pi FL. In other words, you plug in the numbers for that number of microhenries, and that frequency, and you find out how many ohms of inductive reactance it has. You've got 50-ohm cable, and we'd be real nice if that had, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms of inductive reactance. It probably will work at 100, but it'd be nice if you can get 1,000. And as such, any amount of RF current that wants to flow down the outside of the coax cable comes up to the poor man's balance. It sees 1,000 ohms of inductive